In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
You walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. The ancient clans of Lore were described as impressively constructed men and women. Their robust bodies and their cultural evidence preserved within the earthworks across the North American continent were protected and respected by regular stature native people for thousands of years. Starting in the Ohio Territory, as it was known, the sacred mounds were subjected to intrusion, theft, and desecration as ancestral land was parceled out by the end of the War of Independence. Some of the mounds in the Deep South and Ohio Valley date back to 5,000 years ago, according to returning guest Ross Hamilton. It's been 12 years since Ross Hamilton was a guest on the show, and back then, he described to listeners how certain races of very tall people were famous for designing the earth to yield positive etheric energy systems within their environment, allowing for people to reach 100 years old without aging. While the bones and cultural artifacts were pilfered, sold, and at times on display in traveling entertainment groups in the late 19th century, there was also an active effort to suppress this information, an effort making it difficult for research to piece together a larger picture and understand, for example, how the etheric realm was harnessed by these people. Author and historian Ross Hamilton is among a handful of published researchers revealing a spiritual science within the prehistory of giants in North America. His books include The Mystery of the Serpent Mound, In Search of the Alphabet of the Gods, A Tradition of Giants, and Star Mounds, Legacy of a Native American Mystery. Ross, welcome to Another News.
Thank you. I'm in Cincinnati, Ohio, and it's a pleasure to talk to NYC, because I was born there. I wasn't raised, but I was born there on Long Island.
Excellent. Wow. Yeah, it's only been 12 years since you've been on the show, so welcome back.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, learning about the legacy of these ancient clans of tall people is one endeavor, but learning about the institutional destruction of giant skeletons, the cultural artifacts, and subsequent research is a separate discipline in itself. You write in your book titled A Tradition of Giants, in the part The Smithsonian Influence, quote, "From the early 1900s and from the seat of authority created by the National Museum, the modern social sciences have clearly closed the door on the public imagination, broadly interpreting the North American past as devoid of anything unusual in the way of great cultures characterized by people of remarkable demeanor." In the later part of the 1800s, the Smithsonian literally swept over the broad landscape of the United States and with moderated efficiency emptied and flattened the many native mounds and related works, seeking their precious ancestral treasures. Ross, I suspect many people interested in this topic may not know the magnitude of the operation. In the section titled Holocaust of the Antiquities, you write, quote, "Sponsored by the federal government, a nearly utter destruction of the remaining ancient mortuary sites was enacted." And you also have an image of a vintage illustration in the beginning of the book showing a method of how the mounds were dug into. Would you please tell listeners more about this massive operation to collect and conceal remains of ancient people?
Well, it involved many local educated men, not women, and it spread all over the Great South and all over the northern states, not much into Canada, but certainly Michigan and Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky, even Illinois had quite a bit to contribute to this really, it was a Holocaust. At that time, the National Museum understood, because they were receiving a lot of skeletons from people all over the place, they understood that these antiquities were quite valuable, at least for future research, if not for present research and protection. The last two decades of the 19th century, in the 1800s, this is the era of J.W. Powell, John Wesley Powell, who had spent a lot of time in the Grand Canyon, so that was his claim to fame. And he got a couple of good managers together. They kind of created a map where all these skeletons that had been sent to them were. And then they began to locate the gentlemen, doctors, lawyers, professional people, when they could, because they felt that being more literate, they were perhaps more adept at preserving these bones. Now, at this time, for some reason, there were no plaster casts made. We've been through reams and reams of old Smithsonian material, just thousands of pages, and there was not one plaster cast made. And I know they knew about it, but see, these are guys that didn't do that kind of thing. Like in France, they used the plaster cast for many different operations, for creating a shoe for somebody, for example. So it was really going into it blind, but they would get on the average three or four men. Sometimes there were 12 or 24 or more, and they would go out where they knew these earthen mounds were. So you have, let's say, 10 guys that are out, and they have no idea what they're doing. There were no college courses that taught archaeology, which is, people don't want to believe that, but it's true. It's still a budding science. So they would dig into a mound, and they did it in such a way where they assumed that the most important person or the most valuable archaeological treasures were toward the center. So they would dig a hole right down through the top and see what they could dig up, or they would create two ditches on the four points of the compass, and they would throw all the dirt out behind them. They didn't do much in the way of screening it, you know, putting it in screens and shaking it out like they did today. They were just looking for big pieces of artery and human bones, and that was their all the knowledge that they possessed. So when it came to finding skeletons, the native people did put their chieftains toward the center. That was a good assumption. As time went on, they found that the chieftains and their wives tended to be buried toward the center, and they would be treated in such a way where a lot of the copper artifacts and a lot of the special potteries that they developed were buried with them. So they would usually get a lot done according to the instructions sent out to them by Washington in the National Museum. When I say moderate efficiency, that means poor efficiency nowadays, really. And so they would carefully wrap up all the bones and the artifacts and put them in crates, and with burlap and other cotton, whatever they could find, reams of paper that would preserve them from being broken on their journey. In those days, of course, there really wasn't much in the way of people doing the right thing as far as sending these crates or packages. And so by the time they got to Washington, they had been manhandled, literally, and there was so much stuff sent or carried back with these guys to the towns that they were representing, that they really didn't have time to take proper notes. We didn't have proper note-taking until the end of the 19th century, and even then it wasn't very proper. So here you have a lot of bones, and we know that they've been sent over long distances. We know they've been retrieved poorly. So long story short, by the time they made it to the Smithsonian, they just threw them up on this temporary shelving that they had in the basements. And if they had anything of value they thought would, you know, be treasurable in the public eye, they put that up of all their new finds, and, you know, right there in the openings of the museum in those doorways. They only went about as far as the Mississippi, but there's a few Smithsonian accounts that go up in the Dakota country. The Great South probably had, if you include all the mounds that they visited, they couldn't get to all of them. Some of them were on private land, and so the owners wouldn't allow it because they felt that there was something sacred there, and they didn't want to have it wrecked, and they were the caretakers. So God wants these people to rest in peace because they were, you know, Christians. And so a lot of them remained untouched, fortunately. We have several of those right here in Cincinnati that have never been opened. But hopefully one day it will be if we get the technology where we can see into the earth better. Altogether, I would say that in the Ohio Valley alone, there were 10,000 mounds. But if you go down into Florida and up into, you know, Michigan, 100,000 was the estimate. And that's a lot of work to do. And they didn't do it with a lot of care, like I said. So the most fascinating treasures that they uncovered were things that were more permanent, and the unusual bones, like they found occasionally a dwarf, and they would give special care to that. But the thing that really got everybody crazy excited, these men and women that in life stood no less than 7 feet. There's a big gap in measurement between the benchmark 7 feet and below 6 feet. It's just a big mystery, but I think I figured that out. So I was suspicious right away that there was another gene pool at work at one time. This gene pool had a flat, I guess you would call it a preference genetically, for people of tall stature to mate. In fact, we found some comments on that by some of the early researchers from not just the Smithsonian but others, that in fact these people treasured the tall stature, and because they treasured it, they would go to the next tribal community over on the landscape, and if there was an eligible man there that was 7 or 7'5", even 8 feet, then and there was a woman there that was just as tall or approaching that much. We did find skeletons of a number of women that were 7 feet tall, and you just don't see that in today's society. We do have lots of 7-footers, but no women that are that tall, unless they have acromegaly, which is a disease that affects the pituitary gland and causes high tallness in people. I made a big note on that. As the skeletons were described, they were robust. And they had not just the tall stature, but they had really beautiful bone structure. And the bones and the teeth, oftentimes, if they were kept moisture-free, were pretty much intact the way they were. Now, the Adena people, early Adena, had this method of preserving the bones by encasing them in this red clay or blue clay, dry blue clay. And so when they found these skeletons, they just had to lift them carefully out of the clay. In many cases, however, the bones did break apart. So many, many were lost. in this retrieval process.
Well, Ross, in your research, you noted that a writer suggested the Smithsonian is analogous to the Vatican, with its antique cache of confiscated problematic treasures. Yet the spoils of the catacombs beneath the Holy See may pale in anthropological comparison to the Smithsonian's diffuse evidence of American antiquities. The Smithsonian has refused to allow its vaults to be open to scholars from other museums, state and local institutions, and any independent research. You've also noted that combing through the Smithsonian old annual reports, there have been questionable accounting and denial of certain 19th century finds. You further note there were no denials until the tenure of Alice Heard Lichka, the early 20th century head of anthropology at the museum. It's interesting how the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History quietly and steadily through the years collected the remains of the ancient giants and related relics. It's also interesting how you can pinpoint an individual who was instrumental in collecting and hiding these remains. Professor Heard Lichka was called to Washington by the Museum of Natural History in 1903. He was named curator of the Division of Physical Anthropology by 1910. He has an interesting backstory, but his gatekeeping and cover-up at the Smithsonian is legendary. I also noticed the lack of reference to giants on his Wikipedia page. But Ross, would you tell listeners more about Professor Heard Lichka's role in keeping evidence of giants and related timelines out of the public domain?
Well, it was a big tragedy. About that time, at the beginning of the 20th century, Nazi Germany was already spieling that only the Nordic type was the true man. Hitler and his cronies always used the blonde-haired or the red-haired man as an example of what was desirable. So, as everybody knows, there was a great deal of pressure put on groups to get rid of them, like the Jews, of course. And these incidences of naming inferior, of giving inferior qualities to people who were, by any other measure, perfectly normal and intelligent, was the beginning of a mindset that really took root in the United States. And some of the bigger supporters of this, what we call eugenics, which is EU good, and genetics, were some of the industrialists, you know, the Carnegies, and contributed a lot of money to support the notion that we should get rid of inferior peoples and at least sterilize them. And Hitler had already proposed these things, and but it really landed on the gypsies and the Jews to take the hardest blow. But in the United States, the subterfuge was awful. I mean, there were literally scores and scores of Native American people, women, that were sterilized because they really believed in those days that because of the way Native Americans and black people were responsive to education, that it was a good idea to just not support further breeding. Well, we know all about the Jim Crow era and so forth. And in the United States, eugenics really began to take off, and it was difficult. I don't think it was even until the beginning of World War II that we began to look at ourselves and note that we were doing the same thing Hitler was doing. And so that was very quickly squelched, very quickly, and it hasn't really returned. And, you know, black people and Jews have done what is necessary to keep public opinion in their favor, you know, if that's even a proper way of explaining the awful treatment that these people have received and still receive today. So this guy, Alester Litschko, was actually, he came over on the boat with his father, with his parents, I believe, and he got kind of an inexpensive physician's degree. He went to the City College, I have it in there, in New York, and got an MD. So he was a big supporter of eugenics, and so were these rich guys. So he started to rub elbows with the Rockefellers and so forth. They gave him all the money that he needed to further his ideal of eugenics. He was so popular that, as with many others in that period, he got a job at the Smithsonian. And usually it was like, well, a friend of mine said, it was a revolving door of people that wanted to get into government, just to send them over to the Smithsonian for a couple of years and let them earn their degree there, working at the museum in some capacity, and then they come out and maybe run for office or begin to use their family money for whatever pleased them with these new credentials that they had. Well, Herlitzko was among that bunch of people, and they put him in charge of physical anthropology. He would perform autopsies. He would do things to people's bodies, like a famous story of some Eskimos came down to visit, and they got sick while they were here. They couldn't send them home for some reason, so Herlitzka had them boiled to get all their skin off them and put them on display. He was just a dastardly fellow. Now, as time went on, a lot of these practices began to just disappear because it was akin to cannibalism. There was a guy named Ernest A. Houghton, for example, who wrote a book on how we should look at the Adena people, but he didn't really get his facts straight. So when the Adena people was written by Webb and Snow, they had to use him because he was big cheese, you know, big cheese anthropologist and archaeologist. A lot of things were kind of reported in the wrong way, but it's still really the only stuff we have for the rules that were being implemented in the 1930s. By the 1950s, the main major Adena scholars came in there, and it was from the graves of the Adena that we discovered officially for the first time, so nobody could say it was a bunch of bull, these skeletons of men and women who stood 7 and 8 feet tall. So the Carnegie Museum took a lot of those really tall skeletons and put them on display. And I don't know where those bones are now. Nobody does. And then there was another group that came out of the University of Kentucky, UK. They did a lot of work in the clearing of the land during the Depression to put up hydroelectric power. And so they had to send a bunch of archaeologists down there to clear out the Tennessee Valley authorities' chosen areas. And while they were doing that, Webb and Snow went down there and they found these amazingly beautiful men and women with robust skeletal frames. And who knows where these people came from, because there is no race before them that matched their genetics, you know, their tallness. So that was always a big mystery, and it was such a mystery that after Webb and Snow passed away, they just said, well, we'll just have to put this up on the shelf and hope that someday we'll understand the mystery of the Adena people. Well, I still haven't, and that's why I had to write this book. I was kind of asked to write it because I lived in Adena territory, and I knew that there wouldn't be any archaeologists around here that would succumb, as it were, to writing the true story of the tall people. And to this day, they haven't. And it's only because of my book and several other books seven of the tall people, which we mistakenly called giants, because they were actual, not suffering from acromegaly. These were normal human beings. They didn't have the pituitary condition. They didn't have the extra growth in the hands. So keep that in mind as we go on. The Adena people were natural people. And there's a huge, huge mystery, and it still is.
Ross, I recently learned that certain remains of the Susquehanna giants, once held in storage in a museum by Herlitka, was disposed of in nearby Chesapeake Bay. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I write in there that we don't know what happened to the large skeletons that were sent to the Smithsonian. And we have lots and lots of paper proving that that is the case. But when Aless Herlitka got in there, and you know the Chesapeake Bay is right next to the Smithsonian, it's possible that they just ground these bones up and or burn them up and sent their ashes or their crumbs to the Chesapeake Bay, into the Chesapeake Bay at night. I was just drawing a sort of picture of what could have happened to them. Now, that's one possible example. I do want to clear something up. The only proof the Smithsonian or some museum had any bones of the Susquehanna people is only in legend. There's no paper trail leading to the Susquehannocks, which is what Captain John Smith called them, being actually their bones being retrieved. But we do have several mounds that were dug into in the old Susquehanna stomping grounds. It's just remarkable how that information gets skewed like that. But nonetheless, the Susquehanna people had a majority of super-sized men. When John Smith went up into Susquehanna territory, he gave them all these beautiful gifts, and they were so happy about that that they gave examples of their tomahawks and their war implements to John Smith. This is around 1601. There was a pesky tribe that we now call the Iroquois that were trying to eliminate the Susquehannas because the Susquehannas had just tremendous numbers of giant guys, really big guys, that were not suffering from acromegaly in life. And I think I know the origin, but it would take probably 10 minutes just to explain. But they came out of Ohio originally and went up along the Great Lakes, and they were afraid for their lives because many of the Great Lakes tribes were normal-sized people, and the Susquehannocks appeared to have been a large family of very tall people that escaped and got into New York. And there they set up a beautiful family kind of like region where they were kings and they could do what they wanted. But the Iroquois didn't like them. And so by the time the middle of the 1600s came along, they were almost wiped out. And it's said that the Dutch brought smallpox in on blankets and gave them to the Susquehannas, not knowing what they were bringing in, and that caused a massive plague. And so the Susquehannas were pretty much wiped out. Many of them escaped to the Deep South because we have mention of the five civilized tribes having a remarkable group among them of really tall guys that were 7 feet, 7.5 feet. And when the Spanish first came in numbers, they wrote about these guys. They said, there's whole villages of giant men. You know, he said, and Smith said, we were just amazed. These are the finest examples of manhood we've ever seen. And he said, one of our men on Smith's ship, took, I guess it was like a tape measure, and wrapped it around the calf of one of these Susquehanna warriors. And he said they were the largest calf they'd ever seen. And these guys, they didn't even venture any further with it, because they actually witnessed living men who were as large as the largest skeletons ever dug up later, and larger, because the Susquehanna had a gene pool, and they could easily match up a 7-foot woman with a 7-foot man, or an 8-foot woman with an 8-foot man, and get an individual that stood 9 or 10 feet high. And I think Smith, you'd have to read Smith's quote, but he went by the largest man that they could find in the group. Yeah, and just, I mean, they were excited about this. They said, these guys, and they said that their arrows were 3/4 of a yard long. 4/4 of a foot or whatever, and they were 5/4, and all their arrowheads were crystal quartz. Whew. And they were, I guess, indefatigable. They could run for miles and never get tired. And Vindaloria explained that to me once. He was my Indian mentor. He's a scholar, taught at Colorado University.
And he's thanked in the beginning of your book, Tradition of Giants, well, the version that I have.
Yeah, he's the one that got us interested in the subject initially. So, according to Vine's memory that was passed down through his father and his father's father, men could live to be 200 years old. And then he made it clear to me that Indians don't lie. They don't lie about things like that because they can get in a lot of trouble. They're medicine men, and their storytellers were really put through the grinder before they were allowed to hold those offices.
Ross, younger researchers are beginning to take notice of your work and the work of leyline and geomancy expert Peter Champeau. They're finding on their own how many key Indian mound earthworks are located on leyline energy bandwidths. Was there evidence of their villages or small cities being located on energy line grids as well?
Well, that's a good question. I'm going to give you a truthful answer because ley lines aren't actually what they think to be, what we think of them. Back in the 1920s and the teens, around the First World War, there was a gentleman who noticed that many of the towns throughout Britain, especially England, I think, had L-E-Y as their suffix. So I looked it up and I found that L-E-Y was really a common suffix, and it means where the land's been cleared of trees. So other more important ones were Berry, like Darrenberry or something like that, Berg, like Moorburg, Mouth, like Portsmouth, Ford, Barrow, or Barrow, Ton, like Hamilton or Washington, End, like Townsend, and Lands End. So in 1973, John Michel published this book called The New View Over Atlantis. And in it, he described this man's findings. This man was named Alfred Watkins. And of course, he went out to the countryside and he took a number of people with him, and they would just motor around on Sunday afternoons. And they noticed after they got home and that all the towns that ended in L-E-Y, where they went, lined up on a straight line. And so it could have also happened with Tun or any one of another suffix, but he came across L-E-Y. Now, he didn't say there was any energies associated with them. He just wanted to make the point that a lot of the towns that end in LEY seem to line up. And then John Michel came in there, and he said that maybe those towns were marketplaces, and that's why people could walk in a straight line, and they could do their marketing. So it was associated with the ability to pick up foodstuffs or visit farmers that had large storehouses, things like that. But there really was no strong point being made with regard to power being associated by these, unless they all fell on churches, which he did emphasize. Michel did. And so he created these ley lines that would bring together many different churches. St. Michael, they were all going through St. Michael's, but nearby might have been a town named LEY, and where the church was, and ended in LEY. And so he got really pissed off about it when the New Agers got in there. Excuse me saying that, but he wrote that he was just sick and tired of people taking all the towns ending in LEY and making them power centers of some sort. He said he hadn't got that far in his research, basically. He was just trying to be honest with people. But that's been a part of this local folky New Age tradition. And there's really not much to it. We just adopted that suffixal LEY to mean power. So there's been people going between moons and planets thinking that there's ley lines between them. You know, really ridiculous stuff that's been going on.
An interesting take. I've not heard that before. But thank you for sharing another angle at it. And yes, I've noticed those suffixes as well. You know, moving on, it's said that the past civilizations you're referencing cooperated with natural energies of the earth. They were able to facilitate a meeting of two energies from the earth and the sky to achieve better living conditions. You mentioned this in our last interview, but would you please remind listeners about this beautiful dynamic?
This is one of the most profound subjects that I've ever come across as I was doing researches on tall people and so forth. There exists, or did exist, a science that Michel writes about as well. He says that all across the earth was once this machinery that has fallen into utter ruin because it wasn't kept up. And it used to be used to capture and focus the energies of the magnetic field as they emanate from the core of the earth. And when these advances of the magnetic field get trapped, like in a pyramid, and shot up to the top of the pyramid, to the pyramidal shape, it can be a very powerful static charge. And that's why, in my opinion, that's why the capstones were removed, because they didn't know how to use them anymore, and they may have been made of precious substances, and so they were robbed a long time ago. But Michel and others started doing that kind of research, and we know now that there was a knowledge of that kind of research among the megalithic people of ancient Britain and the earthwork people of North America. So some of the mounds in America were created in a conical shape, and they were set over power points in the earth. And I think this is where the ley lines and the places get confused or conflated with one another. But when the energy comes up from the earth, it tries to find a stone or a rock, and or a tree, or a mountain, you know, or a big hill, and fill that up with the static electricity from the magnetic field, and subsequently draw down lightning from the sky. because the male element is a negative charge, and it's in the clouds. You know, every cloud that we see in the sky is held together by a tiny, tiny electrical charge. So every cloud is held together by umpteen numbers of electrical charges. Now, if a cloud happens to pass over a fully endowed pyramid or a big tree or a mountain, and that mountain is filled to capacity with energy from the Earth, which is basically a positive charge or static charge, it has the ability, that energy has the ability to really leak or empty the cloud of its energies. And we see it all the time. Anybody that's observed a thunderstorm in the making, you can see that the lightning begins to form in the sky, and if those clouds happen to go over a place of the Earth where that the positive charge has accumulated, then that will leak, that will come out of the cloud. It will empty the cloud of its energy. It's just a remarkable process. But what makes it more remarkable is that the plant life, trees, plants, bushes, living things that are in a vegetable form, they suck up that energy when the two powers combine. It's a third charge that science doesn't know much about yet. And we've had different names for it. We call it orgone energy, but it's not exactly Wilhelm Reich's version of it. It's called valine energy, of course, which is misleading. It's called positive-negative confariation, or just the confariation of charges, which is an old Roman word that means marriage, the consummation of a marriage. And this energy, after the lightning and the unseen static charge come together, they marry. They marry. They go into each other. They have sex together. And if this is done properly, that life force energy will cause things in your garden to grow really fast. I've seen vines in my front yard, a couple of different kinds of vines. Like, I've seen morning glories, and I've seen passion flower grow, just grow like hell, just like anything. I've seen 7 inches of growth in one afternoon of continuous thunderstorms over my garden. And there's another thing, too, that when the lightning shoots through the sky from cloud to cloud, I'm sure anybody out there has seen that, it tends to, because there's a superabundance of nitrogen, like we're almost 80% nitrogen, I think. When that electricity, and this is really just so stupendous, it's amazing we haven't figured it out yet. When that energy comes together in the clouds and then shoots a lightning bolt down, it not only produces this divine energy, but it also allows for the nitrogen to break up, because nitrogen is an element. It tends to cluster, these huge clusters. And if you don't have rain and lightning for weeks on end, and if there's a dry spell or if there's a drought, when that lightning starts to pour out of the clouds or is in the clouds, it tends to break up into gas, the nitrogen, and that nitrogen instantly combines, that free nitrogen instantly combines with the water of the clouds, and the rainwater comes down and it joins with more rain, more water, and so the rain contains the stuff that has Miracle-Gro in it, and as you observe this, you'll notice that it's like 10 times better than Miracle-Gro. Because basically, Miracle-Gro is the element of nitrogen that's been combined with copper, so it
amazing. Ross, this is fascinating. And this is what you're suggesting, that some of these ancient civilizations had utilized. They maybe used additional metal or crystal adornments to the earthworks, creating the positive etheric environments.
Yes, yes, they did that. Now, they apparently knew that in very ancient times on Atlantis. For those of you who believe there was Atlantis, of course, science is trying to get that notion out of our little heads. But there was some sort of super civilization a long time ago, before the Ice Age, and it disappeared behind the etheric veil. Now, ethereal or etheric is what happens when a lot of that life force, the combining of the positive and negative, gets stored in water. So if you have a pyramid or just a big tower, like a silo, and it's stood up so that it attracts lightning, at the base of the silo, if you have what Reich did, if you had a swirling pool of water, then that life force energy will come up from the earth, come down from the sky, and it'll store itself in the water. And if you keep it stirring, it can store more. And that's why Wilhelm Reich and Rudolf Steiner would have you stir your water before you made their elixirs to put on, you know, your gardens. Just keep stirring it, because it basically helps to break up the nitrogen. And on Atlantis, they created whole city systems where they were at the center of every island. Atlantis was composed of a series of islands. There's over 150 of these, and all of them are as large or three times as large as Ireland is today. But they would, Atlantis went all the way up from Scandinavian countries all down into the equator. And after that, it was another system, Lemuria. But the whole ocean is now empty, because so much energy was stored that, and they manipulated it so well that the towers in the center of the islands of the Atlantean archipelago were allowed to operate in such a way where they would send in pipes, mainly pipes of some sort of quartz, and they would go out into the countryside and they would enliven people's homes. So you could have these lines going from the central collection agency and put it out into your house. And instead of plugs that we use and with electricity coming out, they had this supercharged life force energy that they could plug stuff into. And that's why they ascended into the what we call the etheric realm in those ancient days. And then when it was time, the Atlanteans got a little bit heady about the knowledge they possessed. The wise among them decided to lift the islands up to a higher zone. So they disappeared in front of the eyes of everybody. Many of the people that wanted to stay and help moved into Europe, Egypt, Africa, the Americas, so forth. And they took a lot of their technology from Atlantis and set up these systems. And then there was a revival of these systems about 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 years ago. And in the Ohio Valley, you can see where they carved these mountains into recognizable animals, like this rabbit. It's called the Lodge of the Great Hare, who's a folk hero among the Iroquois. And that guy was really amazing. That's another story. But they were able, in the Ohio Valley, to recreate this medicine. They called it medicine. And that name, medicine, has stayed with all Native American people. Now, to make this more interesting, I have to explain where the giants came from. because it was from drinking this water that people grew robust size. And that's where the 7-8-footers originally came from. So I want to talk about where they came from next.
Russ, this is really fascinating, and we'll have a second part of this interview, but I wanted to inquire if you recommend any sites or earthworks for listeners to visit.
Well, the only ones that I think are worthwhile if you're interested in understanding these energies are two, and they're really close to one another. One is the Serpent Mound in Ohio, near the Ohio River, and the other one is about 8 miles away as the crow flies. It's called Fort Hill. Now, if you're weak or aged, you won't be able to walk up Fort Hill. But it was carved in the shape of a rabbit, and it was sacred to a certain star cluster, star of orientation. And then the serpent, of course, is sacred to Draconis. It was the main maker of medicine. Each part of the serpent kind of filled in the need for the holy machinery to be successful. And a lot of the hardware that was on the Serpent Mound has been taken underground, and it's stored in the hills of southern Ohio. But that's all I can really talk about. I knew this would happen, but again, it's so interesting. That's hard to get it all in 1 hour.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Well, we'll definitely do a second hour with you. Well, Russ Hamilton, author of many books here, including A Tradition of Giants, of which we're talking about mainly, but also The Mystery of the Serpent Mound in Search of the Alphabet of the Gods and Star Mound's Legacy of a Native American Mystery. Would you tell listeners how maybe they can reach you or find more of your work?
Well, anybody can download A Tradition of Giants, because I didn't want to give it away commercially. I wanted to give it away for free. So it's on academia.edu. Just go to academia or type in my name, Ross Hamilton, A Tradition of Giants. And you'll see there are several copies of it in there, but there's also plagiarized versions. Just go with the one on academia.edu.
Ross Hamilton, thank you so much for being on In Other News.
You're quite welcome, and I hope we can talk again soon.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.